From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
And the Emmy goes to Sarah Silverman, We Are Miracles.
Sarah Silverman's HBO special, We Are Miracles, won her the Emmy for Outstanding Writing for a Variety Show. Today, we continue our mini-series of interviews with some of this week's Emmy winners, with Silverman, Aaron Paul, who won for his supporting role as Jesse Pinkman on Breaking Bad, and Louis C.K., who won for writing the episode of his series Louis about a chubby girl who wants to date him.
Guys like you never flirt with me because you get scared that maybe you should be with a girl like me.
We talked about that episode.
I've been several weights in my life, and I know what it feels like to just feel like you're in the outside looking in. There's a lot to be said about it. That's why I was attracted to the idea to write about.
More Emmy winners coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, wow. I feel like I'm going to throw up.
Those were Aaron Paul's first words when he accepted his Emmy Award Monday night for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Drama Series for his performance in Breaking Bad. Today we continue our mini-series of interviews with some of this week's Emmy winners. We begin this edition with our interview with Aaron Paul. Here's how he sounded in the early days of Breaking Bad as Jesse Pinkman.
Yo, 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 148, 3 to the 3 to the 6 to the 9, representing the ABQ. What up, biatch? Leave it tone.
Back then, Jesse was a teenager cooking and selling meth, working with his former chemistry teacher, Walter White, played by Bryan Cranston. Walt used his chemistry knowledge to cook crystal meth so pure and potent it became legendary. Their operation got bigger and bigger, and they got in way over their heads with drug lords, eventually leading them to commit acts of betrayal and murder. When I spoke with Aaron Paul in 2011, we started with a scene from the first season of Breaking Bad, soon after Walt and Jesse have teamed up, when Walt still thinks of Jesse as his former flunking student. Jesse was supposed to sell the meth they just cooked and bring back the money. Walt is angry when Jesse shows up late.
We were supposed to start at 3.
Hey, I'm out there making fat stacks, man. Chill. Hey, prepaid cell phone. Use it.
How much is this?
26 big ones.
Is that all? $26,000?
No, that's $2,600. And your share is 13. Minus 25 bucks for that phone.
How much meth did you sell?
Nearly an ounce.
Last time I checked, there were 16 ounces to a pound. What'd you do with the rest? Smoke it?
Yo, I've been out there all night slinging crystal. You think it's cake moving a pound of meth 1/10 at a time?
So why are you selling it in such small quantities? Why don't you just sell the whole pound at once?
To who? What do I look like, Scarface?
This is unacceptable. I am breaking the law here. This return is too little for the risk. I thought you'd be ready for another pound today.
You may know a lot about chemistry, man, but you don't know jack about slinging dope.
Well, I tell you, I know a lack of motivation when I see it.
Oh, my God.
Come on, you've got to be more imaginative, you know? Just think outside the box here. We have to move our product in bulk, wholesale. Now, how do we do that?
What, you mean to like a distributor?
Yes. Yes, that's what we need. We need a distributor. Now, do you know anyone like that?
Yeah, I mean, I used to, until you killed him.
Aaron Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. I love that scene.
Thank you so much.
And I love the way your former chemistry teacher, who's now your partner cooking meth, is lecturing you about your lack of motivation the way only a teacher could. Now, your character, Jesse, starts off as, I mean, he's a kid from the suburbs who's an underachiever, and he's modeled his look and his way of speaking on hip-hop culture, probably watched a lot of, like, Beastie Boy videos.
Yes, and absolutely.
You get the picture from the cell phone message that we played. Who did you model Jesse on early in the series?
Really, it was a combination of people that I've met throughout my life and people that I have encountered in New Mexico. And so I just kind of tried to form a unique, interesting personality through the people that I've encountered.
So your character, Jesse, was supposed to be killed off in the first season of Breaking Bad. How did you find out that your character was doomed? When did you learn that?
I didn't learn that until towards the end of the first season. We were on the sixth episode, so the fifth episode plus the pilot, and we had one more to go, and I hadn't read the script yet. And Vince, we were at lunch, and Vince is...
This is the creator, Vince Gilligan.
Yeah, this is creator. Vince Gilligan calls me over, and he's, you know, eating with all the writers, and he goes, "I want to tell you something." And I go, "What's that?" And he goes, "You know, originally Jesse was supposed to die at the end of this season." And this is the first time I've ever heard any of this. And instantly, my heart kind of dropped and slowed down a bit. And he goes, "But we don't think we're going to do that anymore." And I was like, "What do you mean? What are you talking about? Like, what's the plan?" And he's like, no, we just, I just want to let you know that that's not the plan anymore. And I didn't know how to take it, but he said that they just love the, you know, the dynamic between Walt and Jesse and the chemistry that Brian and I kind of brought to these characters. He decided to change the whole dynamic of their relationship and really of the show. But the entire second season, the entire third season, I thought that Jesse could be a goner at any moment. So, and they'd always tease me. They'd always joke around saying, oh, did you read the next script? And I would say, no, not yet. I haven't got it. You know, I haven't got it. And Brian would come up and give me a hug and say, well, I'm not going to say anything, but you know, it was such a pleasure working with you. It's been an amazing past year and a half, and you know, you have a huge career ahead of you, and so they would always joke around about it.
Jesse's changed so much in the course of the now four seasons of the show, and you know, he starts off really small time. You know, he's almost like still a kid. And now he's involved with this big drug ring and where there's a lot of violence, a lot of money. At the end of season three, last season, Walt is afraid that the head of the drug ring is going to kill him as soon as Walt has finished training his assistant cook, a man named Gail, in how to prepare the meth recipe. And if the head of the drug ring kills Walt, he'll probably kill Jesse too. So Walt thinks the only hope is to have Jesse kill this assistant meth cook, Gail. So he convinces Jesse that Jesse has to murder the assistant cook. And so you, Jesse, kill Gail, and then you just really become dead inside afterwards. So you kill him, you're dead inside, you start using meth again, and then you end up going to your support group, your drug support group. You want to confess that you've killed a man, but you can't confess that. So you make up a story that you've killed a dog. And here's a clip from that scene in the support group.
A couple weeks back, I killed a dog. You hit it with your car? No, I put him down. I watched him go. I was looking them straight in the eye. And you know, he didn't know what was happening. He didn't know why. He was just scared. And then he was gone.
And then members of the support group try to comfort Jesse. And one of them says, oh, well, the dog was suffering. Putting him down was a kindness. And then when Jesse says, that's not what happened, the woman in the group assumes, oh, well, the dog must have bitten someone, so you did the right thing. And then you say it wasn't that. And then another person in the group assumes, like, well, you must have started using meth again, and that took you to the dark side, because that's what meth does. And everybody's trying to help you justify killing this dog, and you know that there's really no justification for what you've done, which is killing a man. So let's pick up the scene from there, and the leader of the support group speaks first.
How'd you feel about what you did, Jesse? I don't know.
Who cares how you feel? What kind of a person kills a dog for no reason?
Colleen.
You put an ad in the paper, you drop him off at
Colleen.
A shelter, you don't just sit there and talk about killing a helpless, innocent
Colleen.
Animal.
We're not here to sit in judgment. Why not? Why not? Maybe she's right. You know, maybe I should have put it in the paper. Maybe I should have done something different. The thing is, if you just do stuff and nothing happens, what's it all mean? What's the point? Oh, right, this whole thing is about self-acceptance.
Kicking the hell out of yourself doesn't give meaning to anything.
So I should stop judging and accept.
To start.
So no matter what I do, hooray for me because I'm a great guy. It's all good. No matter how many dogs I kill, I just
What, do an inventory and accept? I mean, you back your truck over your own kid and you, like, accept? What a load of crap.
Hey, Jesse, I know you're in pain.
No, you know what? Why I'm here in the first place is to sell you meth. You're nothing to me but customers. I made you my bitch.
You okay with that? Huh? You accept?
No.
About time.
You are so lost at this point in the storyline. Do you feel like the character you're playing now is different from the character you started playing on Breaking Bad? Because so much has happened to him. He's changed so much.
Oh, wow, 100%. He is so broken now. I mean, he was a lost kid at the beginning of the series, you know, just kind of struggling to find his way. But he was content with dime bagging it, you know, just selling teens at a time and living in his aunt's house. But when Mr. White comes back into his life and they continue to go down this dark rabbit hole and they can't seem to get out of it, they're both so in way over their heads. And now, you know, he's a murderer and he's just lost and tortured. And it's so tragic what he's going through.
And murder really isn't in his nature, but no. He's had to do it and he has to live with the consequences of that.
Jesse just seems like he's constantly just struggling to keep his head above water. And he's just this, you know, messed up kid trying to find his way, but you know he has this soul, he has this heart. And that's why I feel people, you know, are rooting for him. And they just want to, you know, hug him and tell him it's going to be okay, but at the end of the day, like, is it really? Is it going to be? You don't know.
He wouldn't accept that hug anyways.
No, he actually would not, no.
We're featuring an interview with Aaron Paul. This week he won his third supporting role Emmy for his performance as Jesse Pinkman in Breaking Bad. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 2011 interview with Aaron Paul. He won a supporting role Emmy this week for his performance as Jesse Pinkman in Breaking Bad. You've taken a lot of punishment in the series. You've been beaten in a lot of very imaginative ways. Would you have problems watching scenes like when you're beaten up or scenes when your face has been beaten to a pulp? Do you watch yourself in those scenes?
I do, yeah. I mean, I'll watch it when the show airs, you know, whether it being if I fly home to Idaho and I'm with my family, they'll, you know, they have a Breaking Bad night every week, and so I come from a huge loving family, and they've been supportive since, you know, from day one, and so my parents are, you know, they're still madly in love. I have many siblings. I have 14 nieces and nephews, and they throw a huge party. Yeah, they throw a huge party every Sunday night. That's pretty great.
So your co-star, the star of the series Breaking Bad, is Bryan Cranston. Did you know him from Malcolm in the Middle? I mean, from watching him on Malcolm in the Middle, in which he played the father?
Oh, yeah, I loved him. I loved that show. I thought he was great.
And how old were you when you first started watching that?
Oh, man, I was in L.A. When they were casting that pilot. I remember reading that that pilot, and I went out for the older brother, didn't end up getting it. But my mom is the biggest Malcolm in the Middle fan. She's obsessed.
Maybe that helped ease the blow that you're going to play somebody who cooks meth in the series.
Yeah, exactly. When I told her that Bryan Cranston was the star of Breaking Bad, the pilot that I had just booked, she lost her mind. She was so excited because she knew one day she would be able to meet him, you know? So she was ecstatic.
So you're obviously very different from the Jesse Pinkman character that you play on Breaking Bad. In fact, you know, he's a meth head. You grew up in Idaho. Your father is a Baptist minister, yes?
Yes, yeah. He's actually retired. He doesn't have a church he does every week anymore. But yeah, throughout my entire life growing up in Idaho, we would go, you know, to his congregation every week, and he would preach. And
what was his preaching like? Yeah.
It was great. It was inspiring, really. I mean, he would get up in front of all these people and kind of just get lost in the moment as well. And I think that's where I take, not that I'm saying he was really standing up there acting, but he would just really get lost into these stories he would speak, and it was fun to watch. And you know, I left at such a young age.
Left Idaho and left home?
Left Idaho, yeah. I left Idaho at 17. You know, I graduated high school a year early and just, you know, the typical story, packed up my car and moved out.
I wonder if there was any pressure on you to be the good kid because you were like the son of the minister. And if so, if acting was a kind of like release valve for that, because you could be all the people that you weren't allowed to be.
Oh, yeah, totally. 100%. I mean, you nailed it. You know, I forget who told me this, but they said, you know, acting is really like a cheap form of therapy. It's such a nice release. You know, we're all kind of crazy in our own way. And it's true. It is a nice, it's a great release. And it's so much fun just to kind of zip on different skins.
When you left home at age 17, which, as you point out, is really young. Did your parents try to like bar the door and do everything in their power to prevent you from going and telling you that you were making a huge mistake, that you would always regret, that you were throwing your life away and throwing away everything that they had ever done to help you in life, etc.?
You know what? Not at all. It was quite the opposite. I always had the plan of moving to LA. They knew I always wanted to do this. And I think really in eighth grade, I made it certain just to let my parents know this was my plan. You know, I'm going to move to like California or New York, and I'm going to try to become an actor. And that they knew that from early on. And so when I started taking it very seriously in high school, and they would see, you know, these productions that we put on, and they would see how excited I would get about them, they were all about it when I mentioned to them that I wanted to take 0 hour, where I'd go to school early, you know, to do an extra class and take correspondence, which was really homeschooling as well, just to graduate early so I could get out to LA, sooner than later. And they just applauded me, and they said, "Go for it, just do it. You want this? Like I love your passion." And so they supported me. I love, you know, there's a great story. Most of my teachers were supportive, but there was this one teacher that came up to me when I was saying goodbye, really, because I had graduated, I'm done. And she said, I feel that you're making a big mistake. What is your plan B? I mean, do you have another plan if this doesn't work out? Like, what if it doesn't work out? And when I told my mom that, because from everywhere I was getting blessings from every side, but I told my mom that, and my mom went straight into the school and just said, "How dare you say this to my son? Like, what's your plan? What's your second plan? What if this doesn't work out for you? You know, what's your plan B?" And it was just so great to see my mom like take that control, because I've never seen her like that in my life. And it was just so great that they were supportive of going after dreams. And because if you don't, then what do you really have? You know, you might as well just shoot for whatever you want to do.
So you get to L.A. and then what? You don't know anybody there. You don't.
Yeah, no, I know.
You have your car. It's packed up. Then what?
Yeah, my mom came out with me, found a little studio apartment, and she just wanted to make sure I would get settled. And it's funny, like the weekend I was moving into this little tiny studio apartment in North Hollywood, a bank robbery is in progress, like 2 blocks from my place. A giant bank robbery, and it ended in crazy bloodshed. And my mom is like, oh my God, where am I allowing my son to move to? She got on a plane and went back to Idaho and felt, I'm sure, very safe. But I'm sure she was scared for my life, but she was still very, very, very supportive.
Aaron Paul, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Aaron Paul recorded in 2011. This week, he won his third Emmy for his supporting role in Breaking Bad as Jesse Pinkman. Breaking Bad won other top awards this week for Outstanding Actor and Supporting Actress in a Drama Series and for Best Drama Series. We'll hear more of this week's Emmy winners in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is an integral part of every patient's treatment plan. More at cancercenter.com. From Viking River Cruises, sailing through the heart of cities in Europe, Russia, and Asia. Exploring the world in comfort. More at vrc.com. And from Public Interest Pictures, presenting the documentary Pay to Play, featuring Robert Reich, John Nichols, and Lawrence Lessig. In theaters September. This is NPR.
Coming up, Louis C.K. tells us about writing his Emmy Award-winning episode about his character's reluctance to date a chubby girl. And we hear from Sarah Silverman. She won the Emmy for Outstanding Writing for a Variety Special for her HBO comedy special, We Are Miracles. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our mini-series featuring interviews with some of this week's Emmy winners. Up next, Louis C.K., who's commonly acknowledged as one of the greatest comics of his generation. He's the creator, writer, director, and star of the FX comedy series Louis. He plays a comic named Louis, who, like Louis C.K., is the divorced father of 2 girls and shares custody with their mother. He won the Emmy for Outstanding Writing in a Comedy Series for an episode of Louis called So Did the Fat Lady. We talked about that episode in May. This is an episode in which you've been trying to go out with one of the waitresses in the comedy club where you work, but she keeps turning you down. But another waitress keeps asking you to hang out, and she seems smart and really funny, mm-hmm. but she's also heavy. She's, you know, somewhere between chubby and fat, depending on the word you want to use. So, and you keep coming up with excuses about why you're busy. And finally, you agree to spend some time with her. You're walking with her along the river. And she starts talking about how difficult it is to be a fat girl and single. And then you try to reassure her that she's not fat. Her name is Vanessa in the show, and she's played by Sarah Baker.
You know, Vanessa, you're a very, really beautiful...
Come on. If I was a very, really beautiful, then you would have said yes when I asked you out. I mean, come on, Louie. Be honest here. You know what's funny? I flirt with guys all the time. And I mean, the great-looking ones, like the really high-caliber studs, they flirt right back. No problem. Because they know their status will never be questioned. But guys like you never flirt with me. Because you get scared that maybe you should be with a girl like me. And why not? You know, if you were standing over there looking at us, you know what you'd see?
What?
That we totally match. We're actually a great couple together.
That's a scene from Louis C.K.'s show, Louis. I think that's a terrific scene. There's a lot more of it. We just played a short excerpt. And I think there's so much truth in what she's saying about how certain men will only be comfortable hanging out with attractive women, and certainly will only date a really attractive woman even if they're not attractive themselves. Do you know what I mean? And the way you've written your character in this, he's just like totally pigged out. You know, he's had like two full meals back to back with a really fat friend of his, a male friend. And so it's like, you know, it's so hypocritical that he'd be uncomfortable walking with a fat girl when, you know, one of his good friends is like super overweight. And
and he's also, him and his friend, that's my brother actually on the show, Bobby, we're looking over at women on the street, you know, like we're looking at candy through a window, like though they're very untouchable to us, you know. So it's a weird pecking order.
So how did you start thinking about writing that part for the role of Vanessa? Had you had a similar conversation with somebody? Was somebody, you know, telling you her point of view? Did you just kind of figure this out yourself?
I actually had a conversation many, many years ago with a guy who was heavy and kind of, you know, big eyebrows and a guy somebody might, you know, describe as a troll. And he just said, and you're not used to hearing people talk like this, he said, it's not fair that people aren't attracted to me and that I'm just excluded from certain basic human joys that everybody else partakes in. And it's true. I mean, there's always – everybody's in that position somewhere relatively. Not everybody. Some people just seem to be universally attractive. But, I mean, I know what that feels like too. I've been several weights in my life, and I know what it feels like to just feel like you're on the outside looking in of the real party in life, you know?
So at what point in your life did you arrive at the point of thinking the kinds of things that you just said? Is that a recent – realization, or have you been thinking that for a long time?
I've always thought about it because in school you're confronted with kids saying stuff to you. I was heavy for parts of my school life, or awkward at least. You know, at least in high school, kids make fun of you. After high school, you're just alone. Like, it's just no people. You just get left alone. So I know what it feels to feel that way. I'm certainly not as heavy as some people, but I've been heavy and I went bald at like 24. So I've always thought about it.
But now that you're so well known for being really funny, now that your show is so good, now that a lot of people talk about you, rightfully so, as perhaps the best comic of your generation, are you much sexier? Do you know what I mean?
Jeez, I don't know. I mean, I don't, I'm not out being singled like I used to be. So I never had a heyday sexually. I mean, I've always been somewhat confident, even though I've been awkward and lumpy. I mean, when I was in junior high school, I asked every girl out, every girl in school. And in high school, too, the cheerleaders, everybody. It never bothered me to get rejected. So I would go up to the cutest girl in school.
Good preparation for being a comic.
Yeah, exactly. What's so bad? You go up to a very attractive girl who's like a queen bee, just ask her out. And I was nobody, but I'd be like, hey, you want to go out with me? And you'd always get at least 1 second of sympathy and kind of, oh, that's no, definitely not. But wow, you came up and asked me. So I don't know. It never bothered me. And so, you know, I was married and I've had girlfriends and casual sex, all kinds of stuff. And I'm in a relationship now, so I'm not out. You know, I don't know how sexy I am in the marketplace. I'm not testing it right now.
Your character is always either getting picked up by a woman or you know, trying to hit on a woman. And mm-hmm. he's always winding up with women who are such trouble. Even if they're beautiful, there's something kind of mentally unstable about them. Why is that?
Yeah, I don't know. It sort of became a trend after a couple of seasons. I think the thing to me, what's fun to do with this guy on the show is just put stuff in front of him that he can't resist. You know what I mean? Here's a beautiful woman, and she doesn't seem like a good choice for you, but there you go. If you're intimate with a total stranger, it's a reckless thing to do. You know, getting into bed with somebody who you don't know simply because you liked their body or because they came on to you, these always lead to bad choices. So I like showing a guy deal with bad choices. To me, the show wouldn't be very interesting if I was confronted with all very well-balanced women, and then we go and have coffee and everything works out well, and maybe we kiss, and that's the end of the episode. That's not that funny to me. So I've been playing that game over and over again for a while because it's still fun for me. That's why I'm still telling that story. It certainly doesn't represent to me that's what women are like. To me, it's funny when people want a show to be an ideal of this is what we all feel is the best version of a woman and a man. I'm looking for weaknesses on both sides. It's fun. But this season, I sort of try to fall in love for real and try to have a more real relationship.
At the risk of getting too personal, have you had your share of experiences where you wake up in the morning in a stranger's bed and think, what have I done?
Why am I here? Yeah. I usually don't make it to the morning in situations like that. I usually find a way to get the hell out of there. Yeah. It's usually right after the act. I'm like, why? This is such a bad idea for both of us. I'm upset for myself and her. Almost every single time I've had sex with somebody for the first time, I should have waited. You get two benefits. One is you realize you didn't want to after all. And there's something about her that, you know, you didn't want to get that intimate. Or you get more fond of each other. And there's more to connect about if you wait.
Part of what you just said sounds like a rehearsal for when your daughters get just a little bit older. Like, take it from me. You should wait.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I do think we should tell our kids when they start making these choices, tell them the real thing. Like, don't tell them hocus pocus, you know, spooky stories. You know, you're going to get, someone's going to kill you. Jesus is going to hate you if you do this. Tell them the truth, which is you're going to feel crappy if you do this. You're going to feel, it's not worth it. Just wait. It's a very big deal to be naked in a room with a human being, be naked in a bed with another person. That is so intimate. That's such a big deal. And when you don't treat it like a big deal, you get confronted with how big a deal it is as a surprise when you're, you know, when that urge is over that got you there. So, yeah, it took me, you know, about 1,000 repetitions of the mistake to sort of start to think of it as one, which I think is probably pretty common.
Louis C.K. recorded in May. This week he won the Emmy for Outstanding Writing in a Comedy Series for the episode So Did the Fat Lady in his series Louis. He's touring with Funny or Die's Oddball Comedy Festival, so is the next Emmy winner we'll hear from, Sarah Silverman. That's after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, continuing our mini-series of interviews with some of this week's Emmy Award winners.
And the Emmy goes to... Sarah Silverman, We Are Miracles.
This didn't even occur to me. Thank you to my Jews at CAA, Larry Mo Curley, and Nick Nuciforo.
Sarah Silverman won the Emmy for Outstanding Writing for a Variety Special for her HBO comedy special. Her acceptance speech was typical of her humor, making you cringe and laugh at the same time. Her territory is subjects that are sensitive, controversial, or taboo, like religion, race, sex, and abortion. I first spoke with her in 2005 when her comedy performance film Jesus is Magic was released. Here's a song from it, a good example of where her comedy was at the time. The song is called I Love You More.
I love you more than bears love honey. I love you more than Jews love money. I love you more than Asians are good at math. I love you even if it's not hip. I love you more than black people don't tip. I love you more than Puerto Ricans need baths.
When I spoke with Sarah Silverman in 2005, she had also become known for her appearance in the film The Aristocrats, in which she was one of many comics doing their version of a famous, obscene Shaggy Dog joke. I asked her if she was always comfortable using obscene language in front of people.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm one of those kids that, you know, my dad thought it was, like, really hilarious to teach me swear words as a toddler. And it's funny, you know, I think that I would say them and the reaction I would get would be so fantastic that I think it, I searched for more and more and more, you know, and I was kind of farmed that way, you know. My parents, you know, my dad swears, he's the sweetest man, but he... It's just a part of his language. It's like, you know, or totally, but it's the F word.
So is it supposed to be really cute for a little toddler or a kid to be using words that we can't say on the radio?
Apparently in the 70s, it was adorable. Adorable. So because of that, I think I've had this kind of comfort with, at least with language. I don't even think of myself that I don't swear particularly a lot, but just raised in a family that was, didn't have maybe the same spectrum of boundaries. It was bigger, you know, the wider. I'm not a oddball in my family. We're all freaks in that way, you know. So I think that I was always kind of comfortable saying that. I think the race stuff was stuff I was not comfortable with until my 20s, you know, because I, you know, for all the right reasons, you know, if someone said something racial, even in a joking way, it upset me. I remember a friend of mine who was a comic put a nickel on his forehead and said, "Hey, look, Jewish Ash Wednesday." You know, he's Jewish, you know. He said, "Jewish Ash Wednesday." And of course today I would, you know, it's hilarious, but I was like 19, you know, I just started doing stand up, maybe even 20, and I would get so upset. And it's funny how I've changed, you know, and maybe because of that, you know, I was so affected by race and stereotypes that I kind of, even though it was never mine to begin with, I think I kind of took it back. You know what I mean? Like a take back the night, but the night was never mine.
Well, were you exposed to a lot of racism or anti-Semitism as a kid?
No.
A lot of it in your neighborhood?
License. I have no license to be doing what I'm doing. You know, I didn't grow up in an all-black neighborhood or something. I'm not black myself. I grew up a Jew where there were no other Jews, but the only thing I can remember from my life is like in third grade, a kid on the bus threw like pennies at my feet and said, you know, pick them up, Jew, like you're a cheap Jew or something like that. But it was so innocent, you know what I mean? It's a kid doing it. And of course, I didn't have that perspective then, but at the same token, he became my little third grade boyfriend probably a month later.
Oh, really? Did you even get what did you even get it then?
Yeah, I did. I was like, yeah, Jews are cheap. Ha ha ha. I don't know. You know, I was, you know, I was raised in a place where there wasn't, you know, people weren't racist. I mean, it was a time in, you know, the 80s or whatever, where in a world that was very white and there were no Jews, but I didn't feel threatened at all. So even when that happened, I was just kind of like, it's weird. You know, I don't know. But, you know, my dad grew up in a very different world. You know, he was beaten up and abused brutally, you know, for being Jewish.
Now, one question about your father. Your father used to own the Junior Deb Varsity Shops. Did he just own a couple of, in a franchise of them?
Yeah, it was a small chain of boys and girls clothing that his father owned. And then he sold them and kind of retired so that he could write, because his real passion is writing. And wrote some novels. And then ran out of money. I had to open a store again, and opened a store called Crazy Sophie's Factory Outlet, a discount women's clothing store. And he did his own ads on the radio.
No,
and they're hilarious.
Oh, really?
Well, he's got this really thick Boston accent. I mean, you can really hardly understand a word he's saying. And he'd be like, this is Crazy Donald, Crazy Sophie's husband. It's a made-up name, though. He'd say, when I see the prices at the mall, I just want to vomit. Come to Crazy Sophie's. We got Unicorn, Wrangler, this, that, all these, like, kinds of jeans you've never heard of. And then at the end, he says, so if you care enough to buy the very best, but you're too cheap. Come to Crazy Sophie's.
That's really funny.
Yeah. And then on the other side of the spectrum is my mom, who's from Connecticut and speaks perfectly and says, you know, things like when and where. And she went to the local movie theater and complained that she could not understand what the person was saying when she called up to find out what movies were playing on the recording. And they said, oh, you want to do it? And she was like, okay. So I grew up with her, you know, going with her to the movie theater and to the little booth where they kept all the not fresh popcorn. And she would say, hi, and thank you for calling Bedford Mall Cinemas. 1, 2, 3, and 4, we're all bargain matinees, are only $2 Monday through Saturday. So
well, that's great.
Well, different. But showbiz family, yeah.
Now, you said that you think most comics are filled with self-loathing. Does that describe how you felt about yourself when you were young?
No. No, I didn't. I've always had a pretty healthy self-esteem, you know? I mean, I'm sure I'm riddled with insecurity as well, but I like myself. I've got a pretty good self-esteem. I think, like, my comedy came more from humiliation and from, I was a chronic bedwetter. You know, I had this deep, dark secret. You know, if I had to go to sleepover parties, I would, like, just pinch myself awake all night. You know, the one thing about being Jewish, and the thing that made me feel the most Jewish, because we weren't religious in any way, was that I was so friggin' hairy compared to these, you know, Carol Reed, L.L. Bean, blonde Aryans that I lived with, you know. So there was that kind of, you know, you want to be funny. You want to be funny before anyone is funny on your behalf, you know. Or, you know, one time I have Elvis Presley's death to thank for a party in first grade, a sleepover party at Heather Paul's house. And for some reason, I had no sleepover clothes. I had to borrow her pajamas. I slept, you know, in a sleeping bag, soaking wet the next morning. and just kind of paralyzed with fear, didn't say anything or do anything, and changed with the other girls, you know, changed into my regular clothes and just left the clothes kind of on the floor there. And her mother came in. She was so mean. And she stepped on my pajamas and she was like, "Who did this?" And I was just, my heart was just pounding. I was so scared. And right then her husband came in and said, "Elvis Presley just died." Thank God.
Sarah Silverman recorded in 2005. She won an Emmy this week. We'll hear an excerpt of our 2007 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue our mini-series of interviews with some of this week's Emmy winners. Sarah Silverman won the Emmy for Outstanding Writer for a Variety Special for her HBO special, Sarah Silverman, We Are Miracles. When I recorded my second interview with her in 2007, we talked about the Sarah Silverman program, her series which ran on Comedy Central. Let's hear a clip from an episode from last season called Not Without My Daughter. It's a kiddie beauty pageant episode. There's this Little Miss Rainbow pageant, and you always wanted to win it. So even now as an adult, you're still auditioning for it, even though you're totally much too old for it. And right before you're disqualified, you're doing your dramatic monologue on stage, hoping to become Little Miss Rainbow. Let's hear it.
November 9th, 1942. Peter found some crackers. Mama says we mustn't chew too loud or the Germans may hear. To think we were once Germans ourselves. Well, Hitler's taken our nationality. And he's taken our humanity. But he's not gonna take our rhythm.
Sarah, stop. Please stop.
Sarah Silverman, did you write this monologue?
It's basically from the diary of Anne Frank.
Wait a minute. Anne Frank didn't say, but Hitler couldn't take away our rhythm. That's not from the Diary of Anne Frank.
Let's say it's inspired from the Diary of Anne Frank. And we use the little poetic license with it, creative license, because then it goes into, of course, a tap routine.
Right.
the least tasteful choice.
Now, you managed to say the word vagina in just about every episode. And
it's kind of like the mouse in Goodnight Moon, vagina. It's on every page somewhere.
Well, why is that?
I don't know. I think, you know, I honestly don't consciously try to think about, like, what's going to shake things up or cause trouble. But I think that we're drawn towards... As a comedian, anyway, you're kind of drawn towards what's taboo or, you know, what you're not supposed to say. It's actually one of the safer taboo words. You know what I mean? You can say it on TV, and it's silly and embarrassing, kind of, and exposing. And do you know what I mean?
Was it ever embarrassing for you to use that word on stage? Because... I mean, I guess, you know, in some ways, one thing you have to say about the vagina monologues is that, like, after seeing it performed on television and seeing the ads for it in every newspaper, it's become less uncomfortable to say a word we were all brought up to be uncomfortable about saying. Nevertheless, when you started using that word on stage, was it awkward for you?
No, it didn't feel awkward for me, but it's funny because there are things I say on stage that someone may come up to me and say to me off stage on another time, and it's, I'm so much more prudish off stage. It's weird. It's like I almost barely recognize that someone will say something that I've said on stage before to me, and I'm so grossed out, you know, and then I realize it's something I've said, you know, but it's just, Terry, there's a time and a place.
Sarah Silverman, recorded in 2007. This week, she won an Emmy for Outstanding Writing for a Variety Special for her HBO special, Sarah Silverman, We Are Miracles. She guest stars on the current season of Showtime's Masters of Sex, and she's touring with Funny or Die's Oddball Comedy Festival. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Florida Power and Light combines solar and natural gas to generate electricity 24 hours a day. Thinkaboutit.org. From Source America, its Pathways to Careers program matches skills with employment options for people with significant disabilities. SourceAmerica.org. And from Viking River Cruises, sailing through the heart of cities in Europe, Russia, and Asia, exploring the world in comfort. More at VRC.com. This is NPR.
Hi, my name is Jackie, and I am an addict.
On the next Fresh Air, Edie Falco, the star of the Showtime series Nurse Jackie. She was nominated for an Emmy this year. She won an Emmy in 2010 for Nurse Jackie and won 3 Emmys for her performance as Carmela Soprano in The Sopranos. Join us.